So I'm really delighted to be able to speak today. So this is a cartoon, fairly famous cartoon, by James Gillray in 1793. And it's called Britannia Between Scylla and Charybdis. And it attempts to capture the dangerous effects of the French Revolution on politics in the UK. And what you see is William Pitt the Younger, the British Prime Minister at the time, portrayed as the captain of the ship Constitution, containing a rather alarmed Britannia. And he has to steer between the Rock of Democracy, you'll see that as the rock with the Liberty cap on its summit, and the whirlpool of arbitrary power in the shape of the inverted crown just beside you. And they're trying to steer the ship towards the distant haven of liberty. Now, we could, of course, imagine that Prime Minister May is the latter, William Pitt, facing these excruciating choices in steering the British Constitution between being too close to Europe and too close to economic disaster. But that's not my provocation today. What I want to suggest is that Irish public law and regulation also faces a dilemma. And my argument essentially is going to be that it faces a dilemma having to steer between two unpalatable choices. Either to become increasingly distant from UK regulatory approaches and British public law, or to risk becoming an outlier in European Union regulatory approaches. So the Scylla and Charybdis, of course, are the law of the United Kingdom on the one hand and the law of the European Union, respectively, on the other hand. So I have to say that formally, of course, and this has been reflected in many of the contributions today, formally, of course, little is going to change regarding either the substance or the procedures of public law in Ireland. So the Constitution will continue to operate, ordinary administrative law will operate, EU law will continue to provide sets of general principles and specific regulatory areas, and so on. So none of that architecture is likely to go away or undergo an immediate seismic change. However, that picture may be somewhat over-optimistic, and the absence of change immediately in the public law superstructure may camouflage seismic change that's under the radar in the future. And I'm not talking about 10, 15, 20, 30 years rather than tomorrow. So at the moment, there are, I think, two major sets of external influences on the Irish regulatory system and the Irish public law system, two external influences, namely the influence of the UK on the one hand and the influence of EU law on the other hand. I think that's relatively uncontroversial. And these influences operate at four interlocking areas. So in influencing Ireland's overall socioeconomic model, which of course establishes the trajectory of regulation, in influencing the background structure and the architecture within which regulation is developed, in influencing the legislative approach to particular areas of regulation like company law, commercial law, contract, consumer law, and lastly, in influencing the judicial approach to the interpretation of regulatory legislation and the constraints on that legislation, as we were talking about earlier on this morning. So the general problem, I think, is that since 1971, Ireland has not had to choose between the UK approaches and the EU approaches at any of these levels. And it's that that's likely to change. So that's a controversial claim. It's clearly not a claim that all of the speakers are necessarily united on, and I'm going to have to defend that claim. But before doing that, let me identify some features of both Irish and UK public law, which I take to be uncontroversial. That's a brave claim to say anything these days that's uncontroversial, but I'll take these to be relatively uncontroversial. We can talk about them more in discussion if necessary. So here are some features of the UK regulatory approach. First of all, in the drafting of UK regulatory legislation, the EU has had an increasingly important role to play. So EU law is now significantly entangled in UK public law, and that's largely because the UK is a relatively good member state. I mean, it resists it all the time, but it's actually a good member state in terms of the extent to which it incorporates EU law into national law. So we can see that in many of the areas that we've talked about up to date: consumer protection, data protection, energy, public procurement, pharmaceuticals, state aid, environmental law, and so on. Second feature, I think, is that the direction of influence is not a one-way street, not only from Brussels to the UK, but also from the UK to Brussels. And we've seen that also in several of the contributions today. The third feature, I think, of UK legislation is the influence of the EU on public law adjudication by the judges. So several major changes have occurred in UK public law as a result of the EU. So UK courts can disapply provisions in primary legislation, contrary to previous approaches under parliamentary sovereignty. New remedies have been devised, including damages. The UK courts are obliged to interpret legislation suspending normal methods of statutory interpretation when it involves EU law. There's a more principled approach to interpretation. So lots of discussion of principles, proportionality, equal treatment, precautionary principles with regard to environmental law, etc., etc. And lastly, the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights comes into play. So all of this was relatively easily incorporated, I have to say, into British public law. It wasn't really resisted to any great extent, unlike many other member states, but it has been a profound change. So the fact that it hasn't been resisted should not lead you to think that the change isn't a significant change. But again, that's not a one-way street. So the UK influence on the interpretation of EU law has also been very significant. Several of the cases that have been, critical cases that have been coming up, not only have come up from Ireland, but also from the UK. And I think very significant cases they are too. And that has influenced the way in which the court has approached the issues. Okay, so now turning to Ireland, both in the first point, I think, is with regard to features of Irish regulation and public law. The first thing I should say is that, as was reminded by the chair, I'm from Northern Ireland, and therefore I do not pretend to have a rigorous understanding of Irish regulation and public law, but bear with me if I suggest there are certain features that are important. One is that in the drafting of Irish legislation and in the interpretation of Irish administrative law, the UK has played an important role since independence. I take that to be entirely uncontroversial. And particularly, perhaps, since both states joined the European Economic Community in 1971. And I think there appear to be several reasons for this. One is the desirability of having similar rules across the entire island of Ireland. The more similar, the less friction there is. And secondly, the practical advantage of having judicial interpretation of language used in statutes that have been cited in other courts. So there's an element, and I don't mean this to be critical or indeed in any way insulting, but there's an element of free riding here that's going on. Not surprisingly, therefore, the influence of British judges in the interpretation of this transplanted regulatory legislation is also significant. And Advocate General Hogan mentioned this morning as well. So we can discuss to what extent it's significant, whether it's increasing or decreasing, and I've put up some statistics there, but the exact balance isn't important, I think, as the general point, which is that the influence of British judges in the interpretation of Irish legislation has been very significant. So in the drafting of Irish legislation and the interpretation of Irish Minister of Law, not only has the British influence been important, but as Advocate General Hogan has said, there's an increasing influence of the European influence as well at the same time. Here's the interesting dimension to this, right? So when Pascal Lamy, the Director General of the WTO, gave evidence to the European Parliamentary Committee investigating Brexit, he used this striking metaphor to describe the effects of Brexit. And he said, Brexit was like removing an egg from an omelet. And of course, the point is that removing the egg from the omelet is an extraordinarily complex point because of this entanglement. So the dilemma then is, what is the future to be? So Fintan O'Toole, the ever insightful Fintan O'Toole, identified, I think, the underlying problem in an article in the Irish Times. He said this, if being together in the EU brought Ireland and Britain closer together, will British exit from the EU drive them apart? It's by no means impossible, he wrote, that events will unfold in such a way that Ireland will be forced to choose between being within a British sphere of influence and remaining in the EU. And that's essentially the dilemma that I'm suggesting, is not just a political dilemma, but also a legal and regulatory dilemma. So my own view, I have to say, is that it's inconceivable that Ireland will leave the EU, at least I hope so. But the dilemma of choosing British or EU regulatory approaches remains. If Ireland is in the EU and the UK is out, and the UK increasingly diverges from the EU, then Ireland is going to have to choose whether to sustain Ireland's regulatory and public law entanglement with the UK, or to break with that and to follow EU regulatory and public law methods. So my point is that the issue isn't whether Ireland will face that dilemma, but how significant a dilemma it's going to be and where it's going to be. And that's extremely difficult to predict. But as of today, as of the last few minutes at least, I'm going to suggest four major potential challenges for Irish regulators and Irish public law. And each of these appears to be pretty significant. So what are the four challenges? Well, the first is a kind of much broader issue that we haven't really talked about, but I think is actually quite significant for regulation in the future. And that relates really to the socioeconomic model and its relationship to globalization. So without the United Kingdom as a member state, the influence of what the French call the Anglo-Saxon socioeconomic model may well decline. Change the socioeconomic model and the role of regulation and the free market changes significantly. So the fact that Ireland and the UK were relatively closely aligned in terms of the socioeconomic model, with the UK essentially supporting an Anglo-Saxon model, that may well change quite significantly. We don't know. If it's France alone, it will change. If it's France and Germany, not quite clear. But certainly the absence of the UK fighting that particular corner means that the socioeconomic model may well change. So the idea of the question of whether it's going to be business-friendly, as was suggested earlier on, may well depend on whether the socioeconomic model changes. And indeed, the type of globalization that is going to be developed. Let's turn to that a little while later. Second major challenge is what I'll call the location, extent, and legitimacy of power and authority. Now, that all sounds terribly academic. Let me try and unpack it. What I mean by that is that UK voters were encouraged to take back control, in the famous words, in the Brexit referendum. And that was a very vague but powerful narrative of sovereignty. The question is what that is going to play out as in the context of the future regulatory approach that's going to be adopted in the UK. And it could well have very significant effects. First of all, in terms of the locus and power of authority in a particular state, the extent of the power and the distribution of that power, the justification for the exercise of power, and whether it's going to be political or legal. So sovereignty plays into all of those debates. We don't know how it's going to play in precisely, but that it will play in on some of them is highly likely. And that will lead to changes in UK regulation across those dimensions, or at least may do. If changes do occur, then that means that the UK is going to have to choose, or the Ireland rather, is going to have to choose whether or not to rely on the changes that are introduced in the UK as a result of that sovereignty analysis and reflect that back into the Irish context. Third challenge is diverging regulation in specific areas. So we can expect changes in consumer protection, employment, state aid, procurement, discrimination, competition, and that's just a start. Now, at the moment, the Withdrawal Act in the UK Parliament will maintain that legislation and those regulations for the time being. But they can be changed by ministers. And there will be increasing pressure to try to change some of those in order to reflect some idea that it was worthwhile leaving the EU in the first place. So several examples have been given. We don't need to talk, I think, too much about what those changes are going to be in particular. The question is, why are they going to diverge? Why are the changes going to diverge from the UK and the EU in the regulatory approach? And there are essentially two major arguments that academics are now beginning to make. One is what I'll call the architectural change. That is, the administrative dimensions of regulation are likely to change in terms of how agencies, for example, are constructed, in terms of their procedures, their resources, their staffing, their degree of external coordination, their degree of internal coordination. All of those are likely to be affected in terms of the regulatory approaches that are adopted. In addition to that, we've also got, and this was reflected also in one of the contributions this morning, about emerging differences from the uses of particular civil law and common law conceptual approaches. And Gerard Hogan mentioned some of those, and there was further discussion of it in terms of other concepts in, for example, consumer law. So the extent to which certain language and concepts that permeate European measures are alien to, or at least in tension with, common law systems. Not that the common law can't incorporate these systems and these concepts, but that to do so requires a degree of thinking and understanding at a deep level of what these concepts are all about, and that in the absence of the UK, as it were, fighting the common law corner may well prove more challenging. Fourth area of problematic development, I think, is judicial interpretation. So several issues arise, I think, in terms of diverging approaches to judicial interpretation. I mean, first off, if things continue the way they look as if they're going to change, there may well be very significant differences in judicial interpretation that will emerge. Why? Because each of the changes that I mentioned as having occurred because of to English public law, because of European Union interventions, all of those can well go. So the idea that you're going to disapply primary provisions, that will go. No damages remedies for a breach of EU law. Obviously, the approach to damages and remedies significantly affected by EU law, that may well go. There will be a reversion to normal methods of statutory interpretation. General principles in the Act, the Withdrawal Act, are formally abolished. UK courts are not clearly going to have resort to the Charter of Fundamental Rights. UK courts will be able not to have regard to Court of Justice decisions. And the contrast, of course, is that all of those issues, all of those approaches, will continue to apply in Irish courts because they derive from European Union law. So if that is the case, in other words, if these principles and so on remain in Ireland and not in the UK, then judicial divergence may well be considerable. Not at the level of headlines in The Sun and the Daily Mail and the Irish Times, not at the level of that, but in terms of the actual practice, there will be significant divergence. And then the question is going to be, the difficult question is going to be, what weight to give to the English law in the interpretation of many of these areas that has been in the past. So I suggest this is likely to pose a challenge for lawyers, for legal profession, for regulators, for judges. And that's particularly the case because, as we've seen, there's this marked tendency to turn to cases from England when interpreting even statutory provisions that emanate from the EU. Okay, so of course, it's important to keep on reminding ourselves that there's no certainty about any of these developments. So clearly forewarned is forearmed, but nothing can be regarded as certain in this area at all. There are three certainties that I want to point to, apart from all of the ones that are clear already to you about what's going to happen today and tomorrow. Leave that aside. Here are three other uncertainties. One uncertainty is I don't know what I've just done, but I've done something awful. I think I'm going to die. There we go. Three uncertainties. One uncertainty relates to judicial activism in the UK. So when I say there will be changes, significant changes in judicial interpretation, the question is whether the British judiciary fills the vacuum that's left by the extraction of EU law. That's entirely unclear. I mean, I practice in London, my chambers are in London. Hopefully I'll now be able to practice in Dublin at some point, but leave that aside. It is clear at the moment in London that there is very significant discussion about how far, as it were, the slack is going to be taken up by judicial approaches in developing the common law, for example. Personally, I wouldn't hold my breath on that, but it's quite possible. Second is a point that's been made already, which is the effect of future trade agreements. And of course, two critical elements are important in this. One is relation to the single market, and the other is customs. In both of those, it's clear that one of the conditions for both access to single market and customs partnership may well be maximal regulatory alignment. And therefore, to that extent, although theoretically the UK may be able to exit from all of these regulatory approaches, in practice they may not. And that may well become a condition for being able to get into the single market. So again, that's an uncertainty because things may not actually change that much. The question, of course, arises, why would you want to get out of the European Union? But let's leave that aside. Equally with regard to the customs area, clearly future economic relations treaty is going to be critical because of the extent to which freedom is going to be given to conclude other trade agreements. And that is going to have a massive impact, not just in terms of tariffs, but also in terms of non-tariff barriers. So to the extent that you're negotiating with China, with particularly the United States, then the reduction of what they call non-tariff barriers, what we would call good regulation, is going to be quite significant. Last uncertainty, and I feel slightly like an unwelcome guest at the party in raising this, there is the problem of Northern Ireland with regard to regulatory approaches. And that isn't just the usual ones that you've seen in the press, but also the question of whether North-South regulatory differences are going to have to be taken into account in terms of the approach that Irish regulators take. There's obviously, you know, the simple example is to suggest that the question of what approach to regulation is going to apply to North-South bodies, that's the obvious one, whether it be energy, whatever. But I think there's a more subtle point about how far the divergence in regulatory approaches, if that's what happens, is going to have to be accommodated in terms of not just, if I may say, UK approaches to Northern Ireland, but also Irish approaches to Northern Ireland. That, I think, is an equally complex problem south of the border as it is north of the border. So, you know, the question of the Northern Ireland Protocol, the Irish Northern Ireland Protocol, is obviously going to be critical in terms of the retention of regulatory convergence and on the provisions dealing with, for example, human rights. To take up the analogy earlier on, I'm learning to swim. You're talking about the deep end. Okay, let me conclude at that point. I hope I haven't tested your patience too much. I'm grateful for your attention and for staying for the rest of it. Thank you very much.